I'm Julia Boorstin, and you're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Happy Monday. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm John Fort with Julia Boorstin. Carl is off this morning. We're going to have our good friend Lo Tony of Plexo Capital joining us. Hey, Lo. Today, NASDAQ adds to its gains from last week, coming off its best performance since early September. Top picks in tech, including today's Chinese internet stock rebound, are next. Plus, Facebook upgrades from a poke to a nudge. Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg's new strategy toward teens and potentially harmful content. And later, Apple going for total victory here. The company is appealing the Epic ruling, as is Epic, after Apple first said the ruling was a resounding victory. Those stories in just a moment.
But we are going to start with the market and a tech sector that has been defined by the volatility in the early part of October. Dom Tu has more on today's opportunities. Dom?
A lot of those pullbacks, Julia, come in the NASDAQ 100. The NASDAQ, the biggest mega cap and large cap stocks within the NASDAQ composite overall, have seen some of the most volatility. If you take a look at the NASDAQ 100 and you take a look at those that have fallen from, say, the most from their recent highs set either in September or October, there's about 11 stocks, 11 companies in that NASDAQ 100 that have fallen by at least 10% from the recent highs that we saw either in September or October. Now, three of them, in particular with regard to tech and communications, are ASML holdings. It's still up 50% for the year, but you can see there are a sharp drop-off on that white line just over the course of the last, you know, month or two. And then Charter Communications on the media side, up about 6% year-to-date, and you can see for that orange line, another drop-off there. And then Facebook as well, we've talked about that quite a bit, some regulatory woes and some worries there about their content and their policing of content and usage. That was a big decliner as well. So those three stocks among those that have fallen the most since their recent highs. Now, if you take a look at those, it probably speaks to some of the themes developing within tech and media. Some of the biggest pullbacks and epicenter industries that we've been focused on have been semiconductors, software, and then the large cap internet stocks. Now, these three ETFs, the SMH for semiconductors, the IGV for software, and the FDN for large cap internet, have each fallen over the course of the last few weeks here from their highs that we've seen by anywhere from 5 to 7%. So keep an eye on those. They could be bellwethers for the rest of technology. And then in particular, Chinese internet, especially within the NASDAQ 100, because there are a number of them in the NASDAQ 100. You can see here today, NetEase, Pinduoduo, Baidu, and JD.com, among those that are being focused on right now. They're all off their session highs, but each of those in the pre-market was up at one point today, so a bit of a bounce there. And then one of the big ETFs that tracks it, the Crane Shares China Internet ETF ticker KWEB, is still up about 1%. But just to put things in perspective, Julia, John, if you take a look at the period that we've seen over the last year, that particular ETF that tracks Chinese internet stocks is still down roughly, you can see from here, 50% plus from where we've seen it over the course of the year, just in a year-to-date period. So a little perspective there on some of the bounces that we've seen, Julia, John, with regard to these Chinese internet names. They still got a long way to go before getting back to where they were earlier this year.
Certainly quite a decline there. Dom, thanks so much for filling us in there. And we want to bring you in now, Lo. Thanks for joining us this morning for the hour. Curious for your thoughts on what Dom just laid out, 3% pullback over the past month. What are the opportunities you see now in the NASDAQ?
Well, I think there's just, first of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think that there are just so many inputs that the market is trying to grapple with all these macros. And, you know, as we know, we're looking at a debate on whether or not the inflationary pressures that we're seeing truly are transitory, as has been laid out by most of the heads of the government agencies, or if we truly are going to see some lasting inflation. We all know that tech stocks are most sensitive there. So I think what we're just seeing right now is the market trying to grapple and come to terms with how to interpret all these inputs that we're seeing, the confluence of so many different things putting so many different pressures in different places. We really haven't quite seen this in some time. So I think it's just going to take a little bit of time for things to settle out. But for those that have a longer-term perspective, say over 5 years, I think this could end up being a good time to buy.
Yeah, Lo, I wonder if this is a time when you really do need to have, you know, especially have that 5-year perspective, though up to this point for the last decade, you could have a 5-minute perspective and do pretty well. And to what degree you need to think about what the platforms are going to be in technology. And I use that term loosely, both software in terms of, you know, companies like ServiceNow is trying to build out the Now platform and be more of that. And then, you know, even Intel trying to build out this foundry strategy, which is, in a way is like a hardware and manufacturing platform extension. To what degree are you betting on the ability of certain tech companies to do that?
Well, no question, the ultimate goal for any company, if it has a software product, is to become some type of platform to kind of go beyond and capture an entire industry, particularly supply and demand side. So, you know, I'm not surprised to see a lot of these companies having a platform strategy. But I think what one has to do is, like, truly look at, you know, what are the people actually using, you know, what's solving some real-world problems that are important to whether it's individuals or enterprises. I do believe that if one can identify those types of platform companies, that's a home run. Look, if you look at a company like Stripe, Stripe solved a very simple problem, and often that's the best approach, is to just really focus narrowly on one problem and then over time expand out.
Well, speaking of platforms and different challenges, let's turn to the Facebook fallout. That stock is coming off 4 straight down weeks. And after whistleblower Frances Haugen's testimony to Congress, Facebook sent its VP of Global Affairs, Nick Clegg, to the Sunday shows. Clegg revealed plans to nudge teens away from content which, quote, may not be conducive to well-being. Clegg also rebuffed calls by lawmakers to reveal Facebook's algorithms. He defended them as, quote, giant spam filters. And as Facebook draws growing scrutiny from Capitol Hill, Clegg said that the company wants its newsfeed to focus less on politics overall.
The things that we have heard from users, both in the U.S. and around the world since the election, is that people want to see, if you like, more friends, less politics. So we've actually been looking and testing ways in which we can reduce the presence of politics on people's Facebook experiences.
Interesting to see Clegg be the one playing defense now, Lo, you know, and a real emphasis on the idea that they're doing their best. They're going to continue to make more changes, but they also want regulation. Regulation would be beneficial to Facebook. What do you think of this? And what do you think is going to happen next? Do you think we'll ever see Zuckerberg make the rounds on these shows?
I don't know if they're going to put Mark in front of the cameras for the Sunday shows. But look, here's what I do know. I have heard Facebook for a long time basically say, trust us. And on the one hand, you know, people trusted Facebook and it didn't quite work out. Now what we're hearing is Facebook saying, well, in essence, we need Congress to tell us what to do. And, you know, I think that there is some policing that is completely possible within their own power and control. And, you know, when I hear some of these stats, I mean, these stats sound great. Some of the measures they put into place were good. I mean, it begs the question that Chuck Todd asked on Meet the Press, which is, why remove any of them? Why not just keep all of them in place if it was the case that they knew that putting those measures in place was going to be able to have a good positive outcome for the election? Why not just keep all of them? That's the question that I think we all should ask.
Lo, it seems to me that the core issue in question is whether Facebook can show governments, show the world generally how it works without revealing data that reveals privacy-related information. That's a big part of what Frances Haugen is calling for. And I find it difficult to understand how regulation can effectively work unless there's some insight into what Facebook is actually doing in society. And up to this point, Facebook's been resisting that. Even this, you know, Nick Clegg is saying, oh, we're going to make some tweaks here and nudge a little over here and show more friends versus politics, which I don't know what that means, because friends talk politics. They made that change a long time ago. I'm not seeing news stories in my feed. I'm seeing people I know talking about politics. So unless they are able to show us how Facebook works, how are we going to know what its effect is on society?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. At the end of the day, Facebook is a social media platform, But when you have over, I don't know, call it half of the population or so in the United States, at least, getting their news from a social media platform, which by design is going to pull in people's opinions. The metrics that these companies use are specifically designed around engagement. And so we've known, we've seen that when people apply their emotions positively or negatively to some of these stories, that drives engagement. And so when one singularly looks at some of these metrics specifically around engagement and monetization that results from engagement, I mean, it's hard to actually, you know, you can see how we got to where we are today, right? It's the Wild West out there when it comes to people applying their own views to these hot button political topics.
You know, Lo, we just had some graphics up showing the declining engagement among teens. I'm wondering if we could bring those back up, because I think that concern that Facebook is losing its stronghold on the youngest demographic, a demographic that's really essential for its next round. Just take a look at this. Falling engagement between 2020 and 2021 for both Instagram and Facebook. It really seems like that's something that Facebook is going to have to grapple with on top of everything else. Now, speaking of regulation, Apple asking a judge to throw out the September verdict of its year-long legal battle with Fortnite maker Epic Games, when it originally called a, quote, resounding victory. Now, the tech giant wants to delay the mandated changes to its app store surrounding in-app payment systems as the company tries to minimize any impact to a revenue stream some estimate could be worth as much as $20 billion a year. Shares of Apple are down more than 6% since the ruling amidst the larger tech sell-off. Now, John, I got to wonder here, do you think that Apple's going to be able to delay this long enough that they can make smaller changes and actually eliminate any risk that it would have to make the larger changes that could really be damaging to its bottom line?
I mean, maybe. They mostly won in that ruling, but they are going here for total victory. And I think the question of how the payment systems are going to work, and I think there's even clarification, Julia, that needs to happen in here on exactly what the judge's ruling means. Lo, we saw that so many companies after the ruling were kind of like, we'll see about whether this means we can go back all in on the App Store. And that there are companies that would like to sort of be a payment middleman on the App Store and perhaps give some different options. But I'm not surprised Apple is taking this move. And I think a lot depends on whether they get a new shot clock to see if they can make this legal case.
Yeah, without question. You know, it's going to be interesting. I mean, we knew that the initial ruling, we were going to see more to this fight. I mean, there's definitely a playbook that exists within Apple and all the other companies. Look, the reach that Apple has, you know, it's important to have that method of distribution in the playbook. But, you know, it's an expensive distribution platform. And so, you know, look, we're not going to see the end of this, I don't think, for some time. And look, it's a cat and mouse as well. We always see that there are the clever startups that are able to kind of figure out how to work the rules within the platforms that they get their distribution from.
And I guess we shouldn't be surprised, guys, that Apple is going for total victory. They said it was a victory. They really wanted to be a total victory. And the reason why it was a victory is because the judge said that Apple did not have a monopoly. The question now is whether developers will be able to go as far as offering their own competing payment systems. At this point, it sounds like it will. If that ever does happen, it'll be a long time before it does. And Facebook is seeing its longest streak of weekly losses since March of 2020. Early investor David Sacks has a take defending the company. He'll be next. Tech Check is just getting started.
Welcome back. Let's get a gut check on shares of SoFi in the green after Morgan Stanley initiated the fintech company at overweight, calling it a powerful revenue growth story as it gains market share. Price target of $25, implying a more than 50% upside from here. And that's after it gained almost 15% since mid-September. But Morgan Stanley says key drivers like a bank charter and student loan refinancing could be on the way. And speaking of catalysts, Robinhood revealed what it sees as some new risks in a filing Friday: regulatory interventions in cryptocurrency trading and payment for order flow, both of which would hurt its business model. Lo, when I look at SoFi and Robinhood and the mass of companies that are saying they want to be these one-stop fintech shops for consumers, my underlying question is kind of that eBay versus Amazon question. eBay had a lot of volume, but didn't really have the right technology ideas and sort of infrastructure investment to drive the future of e-commerce. Which of these fintech companies are making those correct investments versus just kind of driving costly interest or attention on the top that's not going to drive value in the long term?
Well, I love that analogy, having been an early eBay employee. I think when I look at the difference between, you know, a SoFi versus a Robinhood, look, they're both going after this millennial, this Gen Z, these individuals that are just starting down the career path, and they're not quite there yet, but it's clear that if you look long term at their trajectory, this is going to be a valuable customer. I think looking at SoFi, SoFi took the approach of focusing in on student loans. You know, that's a good transition point, also a good indicator based on the loan as to the type of occupation that the individual could have, starting again very narrow and then using that as the beachhead to be able to expand out into other areas over time. So I love that approach. I mean, we see that both with SoFi. We see that with Robinhood and their focus on the millennial and Gen Z. We even see that with the buy now, pay later platforms. You know, this notion that if we can identify these ultimately high-earning individuals early in their career, provide them with something that they need on their financial playbook today, that will engender long-term customer loyalty.
Yeah, take a look at SoFi shares up 5% and Robinhood shares down 18% on that. Now, shifting over to Facebook, looking at the other side of the Facebook debate, our next guest fears that regulating social media content could lead down a slippery slope towards censorship. Joining us now, Kraft Ventures co-founder and early Facebook investor, David Sacks. David, thanks so much for talking to us on this important issue. What is your take on the revelations of the Facebook whistleblower?
Well, it's a lot of what we've heard before. There was actually not that much new information here. These were the same talking points that we've heard about Facebook for years. Mark Zuckerberg has been hauled up in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee no fewer than four times to hear the senators lecture him on how Facebook is not taking down enough content. They need to be censoring more. And that's really what you heard of these so-called revelations. I mean, the idea, by the way, that you could have this Facebook whistleblower appear on 60 Minutes, and less than 36 hours later, she's on Capitol Hill testifying in front of this committee. That just doesn't happen. I mean, your government doesn't operate that fast. This was a coordinated hit. The whistleblower was working with the staffers of the Judiciary Committee for weeks, and it's really to fuel this agenda of requiring social networks to take down more content that the politicians disagree with.
Well, look, David, there was a lot of talk of different types of regulation, including privacy regulation, including more regulation specifically focused on kids. So do you think there could be some valuable regulation to come out of this? I mean, Facebook has even said we advocate for more regulation of the internet.
Well, and that's something to be careful of, because Facebook is a giant, social networking company, can't afford the regulations. And of course, the more regulations you impose, the more that becomes a barrier to entry for new social networks. So I think you have to be careful. Just because Facebook's willing to go along with that regulation doesn't mean it's a good thing for the industry. The regulation that I think would be most damaging, and that I think was really the point of this committee hearing, was the idea of imposing a new government oversight body akin to the FTC. And in fact, Frances Haugen even suggested that she should be appointed to this committee, in effect, setting herself up as Mark Zuckerberg's boss. That's the thing to be careful of. Is what they're talking about is the establishment of a new, government agency to regulate what can appear in your newsfeed on Facebook and indeed all social networks. And the thing to be careful of here is that the First Amendment guarantees a free press, but it does not guarantee a free news feed. And so what these politicians who want, who've been calling for more censorship for years, are really trying to do is an end run around the First Amendment where, they can't control the press, but they can control your feed. And that's something to be quite wary of, I think.
David, I heard it differently when I heard Hagen's testimony. And to me, the new thing, the new emphasis in part, was that Facebook knew of some of the impact that it's having in society and wasn't forthcoming about what it knew based on its research, even in how politics are being executed in even some European countries, which might be emblematic of how they're happening elsewhere. And on the First Amendment point, it seemed that the point that she was arguing, and maybe you disagree with this, is that the algorithmic control of the news feed is optimized for attention in a way that it's not free. It's not necessarily what you want to see or want to engage with. It's what's more likely to both keep you engaged and keep the people who are making content that you engage with making content. Do you disagree with that?
Well, you know, we talk about these algorithms as if they're something, you know, evil and sinister. Let's just sort of unpack what they are. I mean, what the algorithm does is just look at what you're responding to as a consumer and give you more of that. It's not that different from the Nielsen rating system. I mean, for years, we've had, you know, Hollywood produced TV shows or movies that that people would go watch and they would have rating systems. The issue is just that those rating systems would take a while to give you feedback. Same thing with what, you know, editors do at, you know, a cable news network or at a publication like the New York Times. I mean, they're looking at the number of clicks and deciding which editorial direction to take their content. The issue with the news feed is now that you can make that feedback that, you know, instantaneous. And so they can give you, again, more of what you want. I think, you know, the harm here has just been blown completely out of proportion. And really the motivation here is to substitute the consumer's own choice over what they see with somebody else's choice. That's the thing to be wary of. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that every choice consumers make is necessarily good for them, but I do think that letting the consumer choose is better than letting some politicians in Washington choose what we get to see.
David, I want to be sure to get your thoughts on another area that is facing regulation, and that is cryptocurrency and stablecoins in particular. You spoke about this recently on a podcast, but what is your outlook on the importance of stablecoins and how regulation might impact the industry?
Well, a stablecoin is just a digital dollar. It's just a tokenized version of a dollar. And so what it's useful for is just the on-ramps and off-ramps to sort of the digital currency world. It provides a way for you to kind of get your dollars in. You put them in a stable coin, and therefore it won't be subject to the volatility of the crypto market while you're trying to figure out where you're going to then, you know, spend those digital dollars. So it's really a utility. Stable coins, as the name implies, they shouldn't be an object of speculation. I think that where the government can be helpful here is creating a regulatory framework that provides investors with certainty that when they buy a stable coin, that it's 100% dollar backed. I think one of the questions about a stable coin like Tether is it's not 100% reserved in dollars. They've invested the money in all sorts of things like from corporate bonds and on and on. And so nobody really knows if there's to be a run on the market, what would happen, whether, you know, they could get they could basically convert all of their tethers into dollars. It would be really helpful, I think, to audit, you know, a stable coin like that to provide investors with certainty about what's really happening there. But there are plenty of other stable coins. There's one by USDC that I think is very popular that is 100% dollar backed. And I think, and the framework already exists for something like that. So really, I think regulators should just reinforce or reemphasize that stable coins are valid and they should provide periodic audits to make sure that they're 100% dollar backed.
Another important area I'm sure we'll be continuing to watch. David, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on those big issues this morning.
Good to be here.
In the meantime, Cowen is forecasting a 40% jump in net revenue for Alphabet and Google this quarter. Shares up 60% since January. And after the break, Zoom and Five9, Square and Afterpay, ServiceNow and Celonis. With so many attempted tech deals and partnerships in software, which ones matter? That's next. Stay with us. Welcome back to Tech Check. Entering the bottom of the hour now, I'm John Fort with Julia Boorstin and Plexo Capital's Lo Tony still with us. Stocks are firmly in the green. The S&P tech sector up 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 0.5%. Chip stocks like Lam Research and AMAT top of the heap there. Let's get a news update now with Rahel Solomon. Rahel.
Hi, John. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. Shares of Southwest Airlines down about 2% as flight cancellations continue. FlightAware says that Southwest has canceled 360 flights today, and more than 600 have been delayed. Southwest is blaming bad weather and air traffic issues in Florida. The carrier says it expects to resume normal service later this week. PG&E shares tanking as much as 7%. The utility says that it is cutting power to thousands of customers in Northern California due to fire concerns caused by dangerous weather conditions. Crude oil trimming some of its morning gains after hitting a fresh seven-year high. West Texas Intermediate got close to $82 a barrel before pulling back. Supply worries continue as crude is up for an eighth straight week. And James Bond, not quite living up to expectations at the box office this weekend. No Time to Die earning $56 million in its North American debut. Forecasts were calling for $60 to $70 million globally. The movie has grossed more than $310 million so far globally, but experts say that it needs to bring in at least $800 million before it turns a profit. You're now up to date. John, I'll send it back to you.
Rahel, thank you. Turning now to software stocks and who's positioned to emerge from the pandemic era with the most momentum. M&A has been a big part of that story. Deals falling apart like Zoom and Five9, massive acquisition announcements like Square and Afterpay. We also spoke with ServiceNow CEO Bill McDermott on Friday about the partnership he just inked with German software company Celonis. Let's not forget about the slew of software IPO still in the pipeline from Freshworks to iFit Health and Fitness. So how do investors parse winners and losers? Let's bring in Bessemer Venture Partners, Byron Dieter. Byron, always good to have you. I'm trying to figure out the right platform plays here. There are so many companies that are arguing we're going to get huge in this or that way, whether it's in fintech, whether it's in SaaS. You know, again, we just had ServiceNow in on Friday talking about their data play there. How are you assessing who's actually positioned to make good on these ambitions?
John, wonderful to be back. And we are in record territories and wild times, and we still have a quarter to go in this year. And so it's certainly a great time in software. And I do think part of the earlier themes you mentioned come into play here, which is so much of early success is all about focus, whether it's nailing a vertical or a particular product area. And yet long-term dominance depends on multiple horizons. And so you see a lot of these early leaders that are now in the tens or in some cases hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap now looking to move into platforms and extend into their second or third vertical pillar or to add horizontals that can be foundational to their long-term strength and success.
And so we're heading into this season of a lot of cloud conferences and, you know, announcements. A lot of the hyperscalers have been announcing industry moves, trying to focus in maybe on medical, trying to focus in on applying AI to specific industries where perhaps they can gain share over AWS. Is that the right move? Do you think they're going to be acquiring some of these smaller companies with best of breed and point solutions to do that?
I do. And we see this acronym Mount SaaS, which helps support your earlier question of who are the leaders that are the flag bearers that will go into these multiple categories and try to roll through. Dreamforce was just a couple of weeks ago. Salesforce, certainly one of the leaders among them. The issue with M&A as a leverage point to do that has been valuations. These public companies are trading at lofty multiples. The average software company is at about 21 times revenue right now. But the private companies, the typical targets for these businesses, are trading at even higher multiples. We're seeing 30, 40, 50x revenue in private markets with an abundance of capital and a very healthy IPO market that's pulling them in. And so what used to be an alternative to have, you know, M&A in these 20x numbers are harder and harder to make cross these days. Plus, you have increased government scrutiny on the larger transactions, including some of those that you mentioned, which adds a risk element to them. And so we're seeing more and more of these top private cloud companies looking to the public markets. In the last couple of weeks, it was Toast, Freshworks, Amplitude. And we have now a $500 billion of market cap sitting locked in the top 100 private companies still waiting to go public, which we think will roll forward in the coming quarters in a very material way.
Byron, returning to the question of what you expect to hear from these big conferences coming up, how important do you think security is going to be in terms of a focus for these companies going forward?
Unfortunately, security is front and center for every software company these days, whether you're a security vendor and actually selling your services to others, or if you are an application or infrastructure provider having to defend your services from attacks. The crooks keep innovating. It is a market that will never stop. And you have the addition now of ransomware and state actors that are actually conducting, you know, cyber espionage for their national industries. And so it is absolute chaos out there in terms of the attack vectors that are coming in. And we see that the state of security has never been better. And yet the rate of innovation needs to continue because the attacks are coming as the prizes get bigger and bigger and as the value of these assets become larger.
Hey, Byron, I just have a question going back to one of your points earlier about the increased regulatory scrutiny as well as the valuations that are making it more challenging for these existing companies to acquire some of the upstarts. What impact, in your mind, could that have on innovation at some of these companies, given that some of the legacy companies that are already public often look to acquisition to bring in new products quickly and apply them to their customer base? And these young companies look at that as an exit and a way to actually grow larger. If we're going to see fewer acquisitions, what impact will that have on the large existing legacy companies and their innovation efforts?
So I love the question. And I actually think of it from a slightly different angle, which is what impact could it have in freezing innovation from the startup ecosystem? Because so much of innovation has depended on a range of outcomes. It's not just a zero or a one where either you lose everything or you become, you know, Facebook or Google and a massive, you know, multi-hundred billion or trillion dollar business. The mathematical average has you landing, you know, well short of ever getting public and selling for a modest M&A outcome. And if some of the extreme policies that are being proposed in Washington occur, such as freezing M&A among the top, you know, five or so buyers, you create this ripple effect. So not only will those small companies no longer have soft landings, but you'll also take them out as bidders, which will create a very different dynamic. Because everyone knows in basic market forces, you know, having multiple parties creates an efficient market. Mm-hmm. And if you take them out and make it unable for them to participate, you're going to have a very chilling effect on a lot of M&A discussions, which will reduce entrepreneurship, capital influx into the market, et cetera. And a lot of these acquisitions aren't for leading category killing companies, obviously, or they would be public on their own. Quite the opposite. These are acqui-hires and teams that are coming in to help build out existing or expand, you know, new product areas from largely a standing start. And we think that's a pretty heavy and important part of this ecosystem where you get this turnover and then entrepreneurs launch again and start their next thing several years later. And we very much think that needs to continue.
Gave us a lot to think about. Byron, thank you.
Byron, always a pleasure. Thanks, team.
Bitcoin now hitting its highest levels since May. We will break down the mining landscape next. Stay with us.
A war is brewing among states in the U.S. to attract Bitcoin miners. Mackenzie Zigalos has got that story for us. Mackenzie, which states are winning and why?
So for the first time, Julia, we have state-level insight on where all of America's Bitcoin miners are located. And what we see is that states like New York, Kentucky, Georgia, and Texas are very popular destinations for this industry. According to Foundry USA, each state has its own appeal, but generally what we're talking about are places that are epicenters of renewable energy, a fact which has already begun to recast the narrative among skeptics that Bitcoin is bad for the environment.
Mm-hmm. So, Mackenzie, first of all, I'm glad to see you. I was worried for a minute that you weren't looking like I expected. But I was a bit surprised to see New York and Texas there at the top and not, say, Washington State. I know New York has got a significant amount of hydropower, but it seems like Washington has even more. Do you have any sense of why the Bitcoin mining rankings might be different from where just data centers, you know, cloud data centers in general might choose to locate?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one limitation is just the fact that the Foundry USA pool does not account for 100% of America's Bitcoin miners. So Texas, for example, ranks number four, but many industry experts believe that it's actually number one. And that's because some of the biggest publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies, such as Riot Blockchain, are not included in this data set. So this is really good for looking at larger trends around what's happening in terms of America's Bitcoin mining adoption. So you mentioned New York, and yes, that is a hydropower mecca. It's also a perfect example of how it doesn't matter that lawmakers aren't too keen on crypto miners. Just so long as you have cheap energy that you can buy at scale, people want to be there. Miners want to be there. So that is one key thing for New York. It's also a big part. Nuclear power also accounts for a big part of their electric mix, their energy mix.
Mackenzie, as you see these states fight between themselves, I have to wonder what this all means about how much Bitcoin mining will move from overseas to here in the U.S.
Right. And so we saw earlier this spring that China kicked out half of its Bitcoin miners, and many of them have been showing up in the U.S. And Texas is considered to be this new mining mecca. You have a lot of Chinese miners that have been directly transferring their operations there. And, you know, it makes sense. You've got you've got a cheap energy grid that allows miners to just plug straight into it. And then you also have natural gas, which is a huge new power source. And we're seeing deals being signed between these oil and gas companies and Bitcoin miners. So a lot is happening there. And that's where a lot of industry experts believe these Chinese miners are ending up.
Fascinating stuff. The new gold rush. Mackenzie, thanks so much. And Bank of America is out with a list of some under-the-radar stocks likely to beat the street this quarter. Catch the full list on CNBC.com/pro. Plus, is going outside overrated? That's according to our next guest. He says now's the time to invest in the metaverse. Don't miss it. Stay with us.
Share eye on shares of Robinhood today. The company warned in an SEC filing that increased regulation of cryptocurrency trading and payment for order flow could be ahead and a risk for the stock. It was down earlier, but not so much now. Coinbase also higher. We're back in two. All right, we are entering the metaverse now. Our next guest says going outside, well, it's highly overrated, and digs into who will benefit from the eventual fuller, more robust internet that some people are calling the metaverse. Joining us now is Jefferies analyst Andrew Erkowitz. Andrew, enjoyed the note. Got to tell you off the bat, I'm a metaverse skeptic in the sense that I lived through the Second Life hype and The Sims and all of that, and especially coming out of COVID, going outside is great. I went to like this dance performance in the city over the weekend, sat in the front row. It was amazing being in person. Going outside is not overrated. Might some with interest in this area be overhyping it?
You know, it's funny. It's the crux of our note basically says, you know, the metaverse is this physical digital convergence in a persistent real time world. Our conclusion is we agree with you. We are somewhat skeptical. It is far away, probably decades away of this magical metaverse place that we see in Ready Player One and others. Now, the technology to get there will accumulate over time and offer different companies different opportunities to really benefit. And so we are skeptical to call anything a metaverse play. The technology to get there does provide some potential opportunities for some public companies we talk about in our note.
So tell me, Facebook and Apple thus far have failed to make virtual reality and augmented reality completely mainstream, though they've done some wonderful work on it. But now they invent this word metaverse, and we're talking about it again. Why have AR and VR not had more significant penetration both on social networks, phones, and on gaming consoles, where you know Sony and others have tried to carry the baton as well?
Yeah, I think it depends on which technology. On virtual reality, I think gaming in general and platforms in general are going much more social. You strap on two screens a couple inches away from your head, and all of a sudden you're blocking everything out. And the broader technology isn't good enough yet to make virtual reality very social. On the augmented reality side, I think we're just missing some really great killer apps yet. It's the augmented reality is you're still holding up a 4-inch display in front of you, right? You're walking around with an iPhone to augment the world. And again, that's just not a great experience. Where we think the metaverse really has an opportunity, again, is kind of take the technology that's building the metaverse and applying it to traditional IP. And so our view is IP holders have a real opportunity here, not necessarily the big platform.
So, Andrew, I'm a little bit less of a metaverse skeptic than my colleague, John. But what I'm really curious about is when we talk about the metaverse, we're largely talking about social experiences, entertainment, and games. But I'm curious how you see the metaverse seeping into the enterprise space. Who's going to be using this from a business perspective and how?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as we leverage some of the newer technologies to eventually get to the big, broad metaverse, you can see multiple metaverses building out. So take a company like General Motors or an automotive company. They could use a game engine from Unity or Epic Games, not only build the model of that car, but also build an entire street, world, city, and then use that as a testing ground as opposed to trying to build a physical car. So if you think about, you know, a lot of the self-driving testing that's going on, it is getting done in virtual worlds, which, you know, I would consider something like a metaverse-like type world. So I think whether it's meetings, whether it's design, whether it's architecture, construction, building products, you can see where people could build a virtual world to not only test but share and advertise and market through all these different products without ever building the physical device first.
Hey, Andrew, I have a question about the hardware side of the equation. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the leaders doing innovative things in hardware, and what's really required?
So one of the interesting things here that we talk about is, like, people, a lot of people talk about the virtual concerts, and you know, you mentioned Second Life. The actual first virtual concert took place in Second Life way back in 2006. So to get to, I think, what people imagine virtual concerts needing, you need persistent worlds, you need massive data centers, you need hardware to enter it, you need software platforms to go and enjoy it. So instead of watching, you know, a Travis Scott concert with 100 other people in your own Fortnite game, you're watching with literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions. So to get there, I think we need a more robust cloud. To get there, you need better networks for us to access that cloud. And then we'll need better devices to be able to run a lot of the software natively to help offload some of the computing power. So if you think about it, it is a broad step to eventually get to where we need to go. And it comes from multiple hardware players, but it also will come from software guys as well.
All right. Well, the metaverse awaits. We'll see who shows up. Andrew Erkowitz from Jefferies. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
John, we're going to keep on debating the metaverse. You won't be able to escape it. Meantime, don't miss CNBC's At Work Summit this Wednesday, October 13th, where executives from names such as WeWork, Dell, Netflix, and more will be debating the future of work. Register now at cnbcevents.com/worksummit. Tech Check is back in a moment. Forget Netflix and chill. After hit show Squid Game, it's become Netflix and shop. The company partnering with Walmart to create a digital storefront on the retailer's website, in addition to its own online shop, selling merchandise from shows such as Stranger Things and, of course, Squid Game. Lo, to me, this is a very Netflix is doing a very Disney-ish move, trying to expand the value of the franchise off the screen.
No question. You know, I think, look, all of these shows have entered pop culture. They're drivers of memes. There's the huge word of mouth. So why not monopolize on the fact that you've got a hit at the moment? Don't wait. Put that merchandise out there now. Just sell it.
Yellow, and they're spreading the love around. They did the Shopify deal that we talked about a little bit ago, and now they're doing Walmart. So all of that is up for grabs. And as we head toward noon, I'd like to point out, despite that warning out of Red Hat, Coinbase is up a little more than 5%. Zora, the subscription software company, also higher. Lo, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And that's it for Tech Check.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.